Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says Islamic unity can be bolstered through joint efforts to revive the rights of Palestinians. Israel says it plans to build more than 1,300 new settler units in the occupied West Bank. And Britain and the European Union are embroiled in a dispute over a post-Brexit trade deal. London is warning about substantial gaps still remaining. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says Palestine serves as the top criteria for unity in the Muslim world. Ayatollah Khamenei criticized certain regional states for normalized relations with Israel, calling the approach sinful and wrong. The leader advised those governments to return from the path that harms Muslim unity and to amend their wrongs. Ayatollah Khamenei further said, "Unity among Muslims is a principle commanded by the Holy Quran and not a tactic dictated by circumstances." He added that a novel Islamic civilization can only be established when Shia and Sunni Muslims converge in a united front. The leader warned of efforts by the U.S. and its pawns to create sedition in the Muslim world. As the case in point, Ayatollah Khamenei recalled the bloody Daesh attacks that targeted worshippers in mosques in Afghanistan last month. He said the bombings were carried out by the very terror group that Americans have admitted they created. Masoud Shajadeh is a political commentator. He believes that some tyrants in the Muslim world have been bought and encouraged by Israel to back the regime despite their people's support for the Palestinian cause.
The issue becomes controversial when you see that tyrants in some Muslim world have been sort of bought and encouraged by the colonial Zionist movement to support them, despite the fact that ordinary people of their own country is supporting the Palestinian cause. So this is actually one of the great examples. The other example is Kashmir. And both of these places are unique. And indeed, because of the length of time and the fact that, you know, they need to be liberated. I think the level of unity is on a number of bases. And as Ayatollah Khamenei so eloquently said, that it actually is not a convenient, the issue of unity. It's a command of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and it needs to be implemented. And it has got what we could clearly see, benefits for the Muslim community. Mm-hmm. And the disunity, which is caused not just by attack like Daesh and so forth, but American Islam, British Tashayyu, these are the elements that want to create disunity.
Well, Iran has given a new warning to Israel regarding a possible strike on its nuclear program. A senior Iranian security official says his country's response will be crushing. Ali Shamkhani, the secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, issued the warning on his Twitter page. He said Israel will have to allocate tens of thousands of billions of dollars to repair the damage caused by Iran's response. Shamkhani advised Israel to prepare that money instead of allocating budgets for conducting mischief against Iran. The Iranian official was responding to Israeli reports coming in earlier this week. Those reports said Israel had approved $1.5 billion in budget for a potential strike against Iran. Israel accuses Iran of seeking a nuclear bomb, a charge Tehran vehemently denies. Meanwhile, Israel is going ahead with expanding its settlements on occupied Palestinian land. The regime now plans to build more than 1,300 new settler units in the West Bank, despite international outcry. Israel's housing minister, Zaev Elkan, has hailed the project and promised to maintain settlements in the West Bank. But Israel's NGO Peace Now express anger, labeling the project as part of an annexation policy. Jordan also condemned the project, saying it's a violation of international law. On Friday, reports came in saying the Israeli regime soon plans to approve the construction of another 3,100 settler units in the West Bank. Israel has been expanding its settlements despite UN resolutions, calling them illegal and urging a halt to them. Mona Kandil in occupied Ramallah says Palestinians want concrete action by the international community to stop the Israeli settlement expansion on their land.
Palestinians believe it's not about only building new settler units. This means confiscation of more land, seizing Palestinian lands, and proceeding with what's called annexation of the occupied West Bank. In the first place, the Israeli regime annexed the illegal settlements, and then they would be proceeding areas of the occupied West Bank. But at the end of the day, the Israeli regime does not respect the international human rights organizations or the committees, and they continue to carry out more facts on ground and continue to seize the Palestinian land, acting as so-called the state above the law, knowing that the international community would not be punishing the Israeli regime, but only condemning and sending condemnations, nothing more.
Meanwhile, Israel and the United Arab Emirates have signed an agreement to expand their cooperation in the tourism sector. The deal, called the Green Corridor, was announced by the Israeli consulate in Dubai. The agreement allowed passengers vaccinated against COVID-19 to travel freely between the UAE and Israel. The UAE is one of four Arab states that normalized relations with Israel last year under a U.S. brokered deal. Abu Dhabi formally opened its embassy in the Israeli-occupied territories in July of this year. Now, that came a month after Israel inaugurated its embassy in the Emirati capital. The normalization between Israel and the four Arab states has outraged Palestinians, who see it as a stab in their backs. Time for this hour's news review. The Yemeni army just a few hours ago announced the latest advances against Saudi Arabia and its mercenaries fighting inside of Yemen. The advances, according to the army spokesman, were made during an operation called the Spring of Victory. Yahya Saadi said scores of raids were conducted against Saudi-backed forces in the Yemeni provinces of Ma'arib and Shabwa. He said an area spanning 3,200 square kilometers, Saudi was liberated. Now, the Saudi-backed forces suffered heavy casualties also, as 550 of them were killed and 1,200 others injured. Saadi said the leaders of Daesh and al-Qaeda terrorist groups were also among those killed. Now, the army spokesman said the Spring of Victory operation also included attacks on Saudi soil. He explained more than 100 drone strikes were conducted, but did not speak of any casualties. Saadi said the Yemeni army will continue its operations until all areas are liberated from Saudi Arabia and its loyalists. I'd like to welcome my guests to this news review, Hossein Al-Bakhat, the Yemeni activist and political commentator out of Sana'a, and Erica Wahlberg, author and journalist out of Toronto. Welcome both of you to the program. Well, Hossein, let's start off with you. I mean, it's quite amazing what the Yemeni forces have accomplished. Explain the significance of this and basically the how effective and the importance of what has taken place.
The first thing is that the area that they have controlled in Shabwa, they have cut the main road between Saudi-backed forces in south of Yemen and as well Saudi-backed forces in Ma'arib. And as well, what's new about this latest statement, that they have announced that they have as well controlled area in Al-Juba directly and as well in Jabal Murad or Murad Mountains. Those are the last two areas south of Ma'arib city that's still under the control of the Saudi-backed forces. And now Yemeni forces have actually cut the road between Al Juba, south of Marib, and Marib itself, with Jabal Murad in the south of Al Juba. That's why I think that Yemeni army, in this latest statement, it shows that was not only a land attack, but as well it was a joint attack. When they were advancing on the ground, Yemeni air defense have shot about four Saudi drones, and as well they have launched many or hundreds of drones attack, and as well ballistic missiles attack against Saudi-backed forces position inside Yemen, and as well inside Saudi Arabia. And I think this show you how Yemeni army now is well equipped and is like attacking, even though Saudi air base inside Saudi Arabia. That's why Saudi, when they have conducted about more than 700 airstrikes, that those airstrikes actually were not affected as they used to be at the beginning of the war. And I think the main reason of that Yemeni army, the Yemeni drone unit and ballistic missile unit has targeted Saudi airbase and Saudi military airport, or as well airport that's supposed to be civilians and used by Saudi as military. And at the same time, they have attacked all bases inside inside Yemen, and making it very hard for the Saudi drones to gather any information. I think Yemenis have now reached a point that that they have actually kind of destroyed Saudi capability to use their drones, because all strikes from Saudi, they have to get first information and to collect intelligence by Saudi drones unit. But okay, seems to be that Yemeni air defense actually has stopped all that.
Well, Eric, I mean, if we look at it, it's actually quite amazing. I mean, when we think about how well equipped and supported the Saudi regime is, and then we see the advances that are continually made by the Yemeni forces and resistance forces there. Your overall evaluation of what has happened, how is this possible? And it really seems that the Saudis are basically finished. It may not be as soon as many would like, but it is quite amazing the advances that the Yemenis are making. Your overall assessment of it?
Look, I'm a little bit concerned. There seems to be a real disconnect between what the West is feeding as information about Yemen and what really is happening. When I read the Western media, all I hear about is the Saudi advances and loss of life by the Houthis, and it makes it look like the Saudis are winning. But I think this is very much, I make this point again, that it's very much like the situation in Afghanistan, let's say 6-8 months ago. All the news basically coming from the West was we're stabilizing, we're going to pull out the troops, but everything will be fine, and then sudden collapse. So I think that is what's happening in Yemen. And the thing is, it's not the U.S. directly in control. It's the Saudis as a kind of related force that's carrying out U.S. directives. Now, Biden says he wants to pull out. So he seems to have done nothing. He promised on the JCPOA to get back. He promised on this. So many promises, nothing has actually happened except for COVID. That's the only, and the relief for COVID. Other than, so I don't know what's going on with Washington. Is it going to, it promised to pull out of Yemen, but it's the Saudis are going ahead and they have lots of arms and lots of planes, so.
Okay, and on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me right here for this news review. Out of Sana'a, Hossein Al-Bahati, Yemeni activist and political commentator, and out of Toronto, author and journalist Eric Wahlberg. Britain is a warning that time may be running out to resolve post-Brexit trade disputes with the European Union. The UK government says the ongoing talks with the EU have been constructive, but that the two sides are still far apart on fundamental issues. London says it wants real progress soon on trade routes for Northern Ireland, which is the central problem. Now, the two sides have met in Brussels over the past week to bridge their gaps, but so far, no success. Now they're planning to move the talks to London. Northern Ireland is part of the UK, but it remains inside the EU's single market for goods, even after Britain's departure from the bloc at the end of 2020. And now moving on to Nigeria, where there's been another dramatic prison break. Gunmen have attacked the jail in Oyo State, freeing over 800 inmates. The prison authority says the attackers engaged in a firefight with officers before blasting their way into the jail. Now, authorities have already recaptured more than 260 of the escapees. This is the third jailbreak in Nigeria this year. Back in April and then in September, gunmen forcibly released over 2,000 prisoners in similar attacks in two other southern states. And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Brothers and sisters, you are listening to The Lantern, brought to you by IRIB English Radio. As always, alhamdulillah rabbil alameen for this privilege to be able to spend a few moments with you guys as we try to pick up a few reminders here and there from little anecdotes, ahadith, riwayat, ayat from our holy scriptures in order for them to act as a guiding lantern in our lives, inshallah ta'ala. Thank you again for being with us. When I think of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, a few very specific, very exclusive attributes come to my mind. Justice, valor, courage, kindness, and ibadah. Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam was truly the spirit of ibadah, and also what's referred to in Arabic as madlumiyya, being oppressed. I don't think anyone in history was ever more oppressed than Imam Ali alayhi salam, and the oppression he faced was both on a personal level, to have his loved ones abused and harassed the way they were, and also on a wider scale of, you know, his rightful position as the leader, as the successor after the noble prophet, being usurped from him, and so much more. But then, when we read about the characteristics and the personalities and the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam, there is such a high, elevated sort of vibe, sort of spirit in his words. There's so much hope, there's so much strength, there's so much optimism, and I would really like for us to focus on that aspect of Imam Ali's personality and, you know, try to figure out what was his secret. Now, obviously, there are a lot of elements at play, but life is hard, and its pains and torments are countless. And we always have to try to figure out a way to endure and survive, and not just survive, but really make something good out of this. Let's listen to a short story regarding how to cope or the perspective to adopt in regard with the hardships of life. And we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Once a wise man held a seminar to teach people how to get rid of sorrows in their lives. Many people gathered to hear the wise man's words. The man entered the room and told a very funny joke to the crowd. The crowd roared in laughter. After a couple of minutes, he told them the same joke and only a few of them smiled. When he told the same joke for the third time, no one laughed anymore. The wise man smiled and said, "You can't laugh at the same joke over and over, so why do you cry over the same problem over and over?"
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Everything about the teachings of Islam is about moving forward. Even in the Quran, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala explains the qisas, the stories of the anbiya and the past ummah, past nations to us, he says, "I'm telling you this so that you can learn from it, not to repeat their mistake, not to let history repeat itself." But if we were going to dwell on the details of, I don't know, what color was the camel of Nabi Saleh, or what was the species of the whale that swallowed Nabi Yunus? And did Nabi Adam really have a belly button or not? Because he probably didn't need it. And stuff like that, it just defeats the purpose entirely, right? We do that in our own lives. We focus on that ball of pain, a certain past trauma created within us. And by focusing on it, by giving space to it, we allow it to expand further and further within us, and before we know it, we're totally engulfed in this great, vast, huge, heavy shadow of pain and endless torment, and we're miserable and we can't move forward because our legs are just stuck in this pool of sticky hot tar. And the more we seem to wiggle, the deeper we get into. But the point is, things are going to happen. Worse things have happened to better people. That doesn't mean that, you know, we should undermine our own pain, but we can learn from those better people how to cope, how to manage, how to handle, how to grow. Because at the end of the day, that's the point of everything. Again, Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam says, everything that happens to you, everything you're exposed to, everything you experience in life is a test. Not a test to see whether you're going to go to heaven or hell, but a test to, you know, measure yourself, measure your worth, measure your strength, measure your intelligence and your integrity. See how you're going to walk out of a certain situation. It doesn't necessarily have to be a test of sin. A test of strength, sometimes, is even harder. And for us to constantly remember, like Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam did, that we have such a kind and merciful and loving God that hurts more than we do when we go through pain. But he's so eager for us to grow and develop and upgrade ourselves that he sometimes has to enforce tough love and allow us to stumble and fall and scrape our knees and break our front teeth a few times, burn our hands, against the heater of life for us to learn. That's the objective of life, for us to learn and grow and move forward. So wherever you are, whoever you are, whatever you're going through, I hear you. Your pain is valid. I acknowledge your struggle. I appreciate your strength. I support your endeavors. And I am here to tell you today that everything is going to be okay. It's all right to let go. It's all right to move forward from whatever pain, whatever past trauma you experience. You deserve the closure and the forgiveness toward yourself and others. Sometimes the hugest pain inflicted upon us is by our own hands. God will forgive you. You deserve to forgive yourself and move forward. And I hope you have a wonderful day. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. We witnessed the spectacular and awe-inspiring natural beauty of the Kaluts or Yardangs in the western part of Dashtalut in Iran. Rising up to 80 meters, these streamlined ridges have been carved by the wind out of the clay and sand lining the desert floor, creating a magnificent array of high-rising sculptures and lying parallel to the prevailing winds. The Yardangs are some of the world's most prominent. Stay with us as we follow Javad Gharayi, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, as he introduces more of Iran's desert wonders to us.
Early the next morning, I was still sleepy and tired, but some of the most beautiful natural views revealed themselves in the moments before sunrise. The cold and the dark couldn't stop me from exploring the natural beauties near my camp. The early hours of morning in the natural world fills you with energy. Filled to the brim with that energy that emanates from the peace and tranquility bestowed upon this land by God Almighty, I started my day that promised to be a good one. I spent 3 hours exploring the areas around my tent, taking beautiful photos of the unmatched scenery of the Kaluts, a precious gift by Mother Nature to those who appreciate her. It was time for me to leave the imaginary city of Kaluts. a city with great potential for becoming a destination for responsible tourists and nature travelers. The most beautiful natural scenes should either be visited in the early hours of morning or sometime around sundown. I got up at 6 o'clock this morning and was able to take spectacular snaps of the natural beauties around here with this very camera. I have to say, I love Iran with all my being because of its very rich culture and its remarkably diverse natural beauties. It's time to go now. I have to pack up. I gotta put my tent back into my backpack and head out for the Kalouts again. This is my last day here. I can't stay here much longer because I'm running out of food and water. Not only the Kalouts, but the entire vast Lut region are considered as an invaluable natural museum in the world. All by itself, the Lut Desert is home to a world of numerous beauties, the like of which are scattered in different places across our planet. Without a doubt, it's among the most beautiful deserts on Earth. The Yalon mega dunes with their rare views, the Kalouts, the star-shaped dunes, the beautiful valleys in the heart of Lut, the hottest part of Dashtalut, which is Gandum Berian, a large plateau covered in dark lava, the unique vegetation, including small trees named saxols, the Martian or miniature mountains on the fringes of Lut, the central hole, the Dolphin Valley comprised of rock formations eroded by wind, Dashtakashk, and the plant and animal species endemic to Lut. Add to all that the villages with their unique desert architecture, people whose cultures go back 6,000 years. My GPS is telling me I've walked around 36 kilometers through the Kalouts. This is nearly the end of my trek into the Kalouts. Another very beautiful feature of the Kalouts of Kerman, in other words, the Kalouts of Shahdad, is the Nepka Forest Park. These very beautiful plants you see behind me here are in fact the trees that have formed this Nepka Forest Park. Only two species, salt cedars and saxols, which have grown here and created this beautiful and unique landscape. This area obviously looks different from others. The Nepka's Forest Park forms the vegetation on the fringe of the Kalut area. But this green patch fades away as you move from the cold mountains of Sirj to the hot, dry Kalouts. And in the heart of the Kalouts, there is hardly any vegetation at all. But Mother Nature has created a matchless forest in the area between the Sirj mountains and the Kalouts. This strange land formation I'm standing next to is not your simple hill. It is the world's biggest natural vase known as the Nepka. This phenomenon is called Nepka in the African Sahara, Shur Moro in the central areas of Iran, and Talagaz by those living on the eastern and southeastern plains of Iran. When sandstorms blow past the vegetation in this area, they leave behind some of the dirt and sand at the foot of these plants. When the wind blows, some of the sand and dirt is trapped in the trees and crashes to the ground, creating a mound over time. In order to survive, the trees use their long roots to absorb water and other nutrients buried underground. The dirt around the shrubs and trees contain more moisture. This relative moisture keeps the sand and earth in place around the plant. Of course, that leads to a portion of the trunk, branches, and leaves being buried, which in turn contributes to the solidification of the sand near the plant. Every natural NEPCA vase is named according to the species it hosts. The NEPCAs are called talagaz or talatal by the locals in this region. Another unique feature of Lute are these same NEPCAs. They are the tallest natural vases in the world. The NEPCAs of this kind have been seen in Africa too, but the ones in Africa are barely 3 meters tall. At their tallest, the NEPCAs in Iran are 10 meters tall. Normally, NEPCAs grow on flat surfaces. They best grow on moist land. The shape of the NEPCA depends on the size, density, and growth rate of the host plant. In this NEPCA forest, the dominant species is the salt cedar. My goodness, it looks more like a miracle. Just look how God instilled the hope for life in these salt cedars and saxols. When they're just small seedlings, winds dump massive amounts of sand onto them. But driven by their strong will to live, they continue to grow in order to survive. The battle between the wind and sand on one hand and these trees on the other has been going on forever. It's been around for millions of years. But what is really very important is that hope keeps everything and everyone alive. And these trees, because of their intrinsic sense of hope, the will for life, put their roots down and stand tall. They continue to grow as a means of survival. It's going to become stormy very soon. Desert storms are very dangerous. So what you need to do is find shelter somewhere or leave that area immediately. Fortunately, I'm very close to my next destination and I think I'm not going to run into any trouble. But I have to get going immediately or I'm going to get sand and dirt all over my body and stuff. My camera crew and I were taken off guard by the sudden change of weather and the subsequent sandstorm. One of the biggest powers of nature in a desert is the ability of sand and dust to penetrate each and every orifice during a storm, and our equipment was no exception. Sandstorms are among the biggest dangers of a desert. In some cases, such storms continue to blow for days and can cost nature travelers their lives. But there are other dangers lurking in other parts of this vast plain. Therefore, the best way to ensure a safe trip to Lute is to make the necessary arrangements with the relevant authorities in Kerman province and the city of Shahdad. From Shahdad, I had to walk around 250 kilometers to the west of the province, to a place only 15 kilometers away from Rafsanjan. Kerman is a province with limited water resources. Many of the deep wells in the province have dried up. But deep in the heart of Rafsanjan's crisis-hit nature, there is a canyon that sparkles like a diamond. You might be thinking this isn't Iran, that I'm speaking to you from another country. But you're wrong. This is our beloved Iran, and I'm now standing atop a scary deep canyon, the Raga Grand Canyon of Rafsanjan. Valleys and canyons are strange yet beautiful natural phenomena, and they become even more beautiful if their emergence is not the result of orogeny, rather if it's the result of thousands or millions of years of erosion by wind, sand, and water of flat plains. Raga Grand Canyon is one such ravine, a peerless, pristine valley in Kerman Province. I was amazed at the view of the canyon from above. The pointed cones, the big and small columns carved out by erosion, the arcs, the partitions and wall-like strips were only a few of all the beautiful features of this canyon. Raga is around 20 kilometers long. Its width varies between 3 and 100 kilometers, and in some places it is around 80 meters deep. Walking on top of it could have been very dangerous. My goodness, it's really scary, but it's magnificent at the same time. At this point, I think it's around 70 meters deep from where I'm standing. If I fall into it, there will be nothing left of me. It's dangerous to be here because the earth here is very soft and can slide at any moment. So you'll have to keep a safe distance while walking along these beautiful walls. It's ruggedly beautiful indeed. You can get the most beautiful view of the canyon from up here, but every side of it offers its own unique beauty. What I'm really happy about is the fact that there is no construction work happening anywhere in a 20-kilometer radius. There are no roads. That's why this ravine has maintained its pristine status, and of course, the area around it too. My hope is that we can preserve this untouched ravine and its surroundings the way they are and leave them to the next generation, and they to the generation that comes after them, just like the way it looks now. I hope so. The canyon's geomorphology and its pristine environs made for beautiful scenery, and that had provided a good habitat for certain species of animals in and around it. This region and this gorge are so intact, they have become home to various species of birds, such as eagles that have built their nests in recesses high on the walls where they feel safe. I'm very excited and counting every minute for the walk on the bed of the canyon, but the best time to do it would be tomorrow because I don't have enough time for it today. Raga Canyon is a good destination for geologists and nature travelers venturing into the Lute. The vegetation, such as salt cedar trees in some parts of the canyon, made the canyon even more beautiful. From the bottom up, ravines look just as beautiful. I walked along much of Raga Canyon from above and captured many beautiful views of it, but it was now time to go down to the bottom of it. This part of the wall is solid. It's hard to walk on. It's very steep too, as you can see. You have to take a lot of care going down. My God, yes! At the bottom, the canyon was beautiful and scary. I kept thinking its walls were going to come crashing down any minute. Walking at the foot of those majestic walls, I felt how little and weak I was compared to the canyon and to its creator. On one hand, the beautiful long natural statues, and on the other, the tunnel-shaped arcs carved into the walls were all astonishing. Statues chiseled by gravity pulling down the dirt and pebbles on the walls of the ravine. The view down here is simply breathtaking. The huge, majestic statues carved out on the walls of the canyon have taken thousands of years to be made. As loose earth from the top of the canyon cascaded down to the bottom over the years, it created these beautiful shapes on these walls. They are stunning. Some of them look like humans and others like certain animals. This canyon is just as beautiful down on its bed as it is from above. This dry tree over here, in fact, there are many others scattered across the ravine. Floodwaters on the highlands and on the plains sweep them up along with some of the trees that grow at the mouth of the canyon in spring and dump them over here. It's a bizarre scene here. It's very dangerous to come here in the spring season because floodwaters are deadly. Ravine exploration is among the most interesting fields in nature traveling. There are many adventurers around the world who are in love with exploring valleys and canyons. But this field of sport comes with its own hidden dangers. The collapse of the walls or falling from the edge of a canyon's walls are among those dangers. But there's another more serious threat to the life of nature travelers, which is seasonal floodwaters caused by rainfall. Just take a look at what seasonal rivers have done to these walls. The water can be around 2 meters deep here at the time of a flood and can be fatal. Whenever I travel to a place like this, I study up on its weather and climate before I set out so I won't run into any trouble. So when it's raining, you better not be anywhere near the bottom of any ravine. Although Raga Canyon is very wide and the floodwaters flowing in pose a less serious threat, it is likely for torrential rain to come down in the nearby areas. And that means flash floods at a certain time during a day or night or a whole day. So at a time like that, you better not come here. Most nature travelers take all kinds of precautions prior to their adventure. But most of them don't pay much attention to the climate of the places they travel to. They don't take the weather forecasts very seriously. In 2005, 11 mountaineers from Ghazvin, with all their equipment and years of experience, entered Andres Canyon in Alborz province. But because they had ignored the weather forecast and the predicted rain, they had an accident. During rainfalls, valleys and canyons that offer no escapes are the most dangerous places in the natural world to be. In that year, heavy rain set off floodwaters in Andres Canyon, and unfortunately, it took the lives of all 11 mountaineers. Therefore, the most important thing that natural explorers should take into account is the weather forecast, the difficulty of the route they're traveling on, and their mental and physical strength for the trip ahead. You can't put a price tag on the environment. All those who walk into nature speak of it as a cathartic experience and absorb massive amounts of positive energy. In my opinion, because the natural world is a manifestation of the greatness and beauty of God, I have walked a very long distance. I'm about to arrive at the end of the canyon. I'm going to have to get out of it before dark sets in, concluding another leg of my trip. It's very easy to pollute your environment. But that's not right. It only goes to show how irresponsible we humans can be. We have to take responsibility for the environment in our country and in the entire planet. We mustn't dump our garbage out in the open and instead send it to the recycling system. We must treat nature the same way we do our homes. Only then can we say we are committed to other humans, to the planet Earth, and to future generations. I'm approaching the end of my trip. I have no doubt that many of my countrymen and women are not familiar with the beautiful natural wonders of Kerman province. And many of the officials in the province don't seem to be aware of the great potential these natural wonders have as tourist destinations. In addition to its old history and culture, the province boasts unique natural features on a par with their counterparts in the rest of the world. In the developed world, development doesn't include building roads, hotels, and tourism centers in the heart of the environment. In the century we live in, development and progress is tantamount to the unconditional and responsible preservation of the environment, and sustainable development of the tourism industry can easily set in motion the big wheels of the country's economy. The environment in Iran is very fragile and sensitive, but with proper professional preservation and protection, by people and officials alike, it can turn into a big generator of jobs and revenues, provided that we appreciate what we have and do all we can to preserve what's left of Iran's untapped natural world. We should perish the thought of construction on it.
I'm sure you'll agree with me that Iran's deserts, with their varied and dramatic landscapes of canyons, yardangs, and their beautiful flora and fauna, are a unique destination for the demanding traveler to discover a wealth of exceptional and unspoiled views. And that's it for this week. Do keep in touch with us, and until next week, goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.